Hello and welcome to the Playground Podcast. I'm Chris Burr. My co-host and cohort Richard Gottlieb is joining us on the keys, and we are really excited. Right, he's joining us on the keys. You can't see it, but he's miming keys today. This is the Playground Podcast, and we are supported by Global Toy Experts, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. And today we're really excited to talk about toy invention, a new toy, and with a guy who's been around in the industry for a while. He's Dan Klitzner, and he's an award-winning industrial designer, and you know him from Bop It. Dan, welcome. It's nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you. I'm very excited to be here with both you guys and talk about invention.
So tell us a little bit about Freefall, which is your latest product that's coming out from Ravensburger. A little bit about what it is, the process, and then we'll get into how do you invent a toy these days.
Freefall is kind of on a bucket list for me, which was to do something with ThinkFun, because I've always admired ThinkFun and thought with all the products that I've done that are three-dimensional, that there would be something there that was a challenge puzzle type of format, and have tried for many years. And luckily, Josh West at ThinkFun is so good at working with inventors that he really encouraged some of these directions that I was going into for some time. Eventually, we were able to make this thing that's actually been 22 years in the making. If you want to know the genesis of Freefall, it started a long time ago. So it's great to see it out there.
Now, I have not seen the product in person yet, but I have seen the picture, and it's really interesting. It's kind of like Perplexus meets building. How does it work?
It was inspired, you know, as I co-created Perplexus, and for many years wanted to have a build your own version of it, and realized that it was much better as a fit for ThinkFun, where you have a challenge. So you're given, if you imagine, you know, a marble maze of any kind, but more like a Perplexus where you turn it in the air, you start with a challenge on a piece of paper, use these three or four pieces to get from the beginning to the end of this marble maze. So you have to decide where to put them to create the path. And if you played Gravity Maze from them, it's similar in that format. It's just that just uses gravity to come down through an actual marble track. This is the idea that you have to figure out not just the pathway, but which way to turn the structure in your hands so that the marble will free fall from one to the other. And instead of there being any pathways, it's all just about falling. So you're creating this pathway that things have to drop. And as you get more and more complicated with the puzzles, it's really fun to figure out how to put them all together so that you can get this marble from one end to the other.
I love that. I think it's really fascinating because of all the different centers in the brain that it activates in doing it. Before we go into that a little further, is there a place where people can see this? Is it on the ThinkFun website? Can people click onto that?
Yes. I think I just saw it there.
Great. Also, before we go any further, tell us a little bit about your journey of becoming a toy inventor, a successful one at that. That is one of Richard's favorite questions to ask people on this show.
Well, if you want to start when I was maybe 8 years old, I used to draw a lot of monsters and gadgets, and I have drawings of these crazy things that were sort of not just organic, but lots of doodads, and I might say the predecessor to this sort of boppity look of things. And I had showbiz parents who were on Broadway, who later then got real jobs in the Bay Area and encouraged a lot of creativity. So I think it started with me growing up around a very theatrical, fun family. We played a lot of games. I, though, was more serious with my pursuits. When I went to college, I went to school for engineering and was extremely unhappy because I really wanted to create things, and all that was doing was calculating things. So my dad, who was on a film shoot, was telling the director about his son, and the director said, "Have you ever heard of the school called Art Center in Pasadena where they teach industrial design?" And he sent away for a catalog. I got this catalog, opened it up, and said, "Oh my God, that's what I want to do. I want to do that, whatever that is." And I can still remember it. It just changed my life, because there's nothing more powerful as finding what you want to do. If you find it, there'll be nothing to stop you from doing it, is my theory. So I saw that. I put 100% of my effort into getting into that school and learning industrial design, which I loved. Then if you think about it, you know, a lot of the products I've created are really a combination of industrial design meets game. They're very three-dimensional. And a lot of the things are meant to sit on the table or to be held and turned, and like a Perplexus or Bopit or even the Simon Air. If you look at Simon Air, they're all sculptural. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of my goal, is to combine those loves. In terms of games and toys, you know, I've just loved being in the industry, getting wish lists from different companies and trying to figure out fun new solutions for those things.
One of the things we were talking about before we started recording was AI. It's something we're going to be seeing a lot more of in the toy industry. And as a designer, what do you think about AI and where are its applications in the toy business?
Well, I just started using it a couple months ago. My kids showed it to me and I got scared and excited. The thing that's great about it, I don't know if I can read something. We put in just something silly like, what is a game that uses peanut butter for five-year-olds? Just put that in. Just ask that of the AI. Nothing else. So just to give an example how funny and great it is, it says, sure, here's an idea for a game involving peanut butter that could be easy for five-year-olds. Peanut Butter Puzzle Challenge. The AI named it that. I didn't. Players are given a small container of peanut butter and a set of puzzle pieces that are covered in peanut butter. The goal of the game is to fit the puzzle pieces together to form a complete picture while avoiding getting too much peanut butter on their hands. To play, the players can take turns selecting a puzzle piece and attempting to fit it into the correct spot. If a player successfully fits a piece, they can lick the peanut butter off their hands and keep playing. If they get too much peanut butter in their hands and can't continue playing, they're out of the game. The game could have a different difficulty level with more complex puzzles for older children and simpler ones for younger ones. Additionally, to make the game more challenging, the players could have a time limit to complete the puzzle. Okay, so that is a one out of a million of what happens when you give a prompt to AI. And I've done some others that are far more extensive that will blow you away. It's a silly idea, which is what you wouldn't expect, is that it's so structured. Like, it actually puts things into a format. And I don't know where it comes from, but, you know, you can imagine started going crazy putting premises into this thing. It's like the ultimate brainstormer that can bounce ideas off you, that it's just like having an intern that's wildly creative that's going to take your job.
And what platform were you using for the AI?
ChatGPT.
Do you think that that's going to impact gameplay? I mean, that game has a lot of problems. I mean, I can see you proposing that game to somebody like ThinkFun and them going, yeah, what else you got?
Yeah. No, of course, I read the one that wasn't viable because why would I tell everyone the good ideas? For people who haven't tried it, it isn't just like garbled gibberish. It's everything you do has a very thought out structure. There's a game show idea I had, and I put it in there and it came back with like a full report that was so structured and so almost ready to go. And so I think that's the part that, of course, if you're a creative person, you can then bounce off that and use it as a starting point, not an ending point. But who knows, you know, where it's going. I just had no idea it was so powerful.
And do you think that people will be using it in game design as a creative assistant?
Yes, I will be. And I imagine if you've ever had trouble writing rules for something, for instance, or just writing up a description, you can put it in there and say, make this shorter, or make this friendlier, or make this more forceful, whatever you want. It's kind of amazing how it'll sit there and work with what you have as well. So I just think we're at such a beginning stage that people will learn to use it, similar to when Photoshop or Illustrator came on and everyone said, oh, hey, that's not fair. Right. And you're like, well, you just have to learn how to use the tools. And it's now another powerful tool.
I remember in my early days in the toy industry, working creative services and proofreading mechanicals with overlays and all of that stuff. And all of that is gone. We had somebody whose job was just to set the type for our packages. That job is gone.
Exactly. And this is simply an evolution of that, but it's an incredibly powerful one because for the first time, it's actually generating creativity that makes you question, what is creativity? because I saw some of the things I put in there, even the thing, the silly thing I just read, was that creativity or was it just, you know, mashing up ideas? It actually had, it kind of made sense, right?
Right.
It was, but it wasn't like just made no sense at all. So it's really shook me. Like, what am I creative? Am I just like a computer that mashes up ideas? You know, really interesting.
And the answer to that is yes. Now, Reuben Claimer, this is another favorite question from Richard. Reuben Claimer, the inventor of Game of Life, had a warehouse he called the Warehouse of Broken Dreams. It was where he kept all his failures. Do you think that that's one of the components of being an inventor is the ability to keep going, to learn from failures and keep trying?
I certainly have my own warehouse of failures. But actually, it is not just a requirement, but it's a requirement to know where they are and to organize them. So if you come to our office, we have these rows, I know Richard's been there, these rows of cabinets where the successes are all displayed on the top. But inside those cabinets, it's like our little hall of fame. If I show people above and below are these very slick looking cabinets with numbers on them, that's all of the failures or not yet, they have not yet risen to the top and become published products. But it's knowing, you know, well, we tried this, many things 10 years later become a hit. So it's not just being able to fail to kind of try things that don't work, but then knowing the right time, the right product, the right company, the right person, the right, you know, I have this whole talk about right, R-I-T-E, to sell an idea, everything has to be right. And that right is the tough part, but that's a lot of what we do as inventors. People come to the office, we might think we're showing them one thing, they say something else, we go, oh, I have something in the cupboard and I know where to find it. Right? I know where it is because we have quite a system we've established. My partner Gary has put a whole file maker system where we can tag and find that thing that we remember from 10 years ago, pull it out, and often things like HyperDash came out of that, which was a huge hit with Wild Planet. Yeah. Literally came out of a conversation at lunch with Danny Grossman long ago. I said, you know, I have something, you should see it. It was 10 years old, but of course, right idea, right time, right person, right company.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the development process. We are a long way from Richard Knurr and Spud Mellon creating things in their shed in California and taking them down to the beach. And if kids liked it, they made it. What's the process like of selling an invention today, and how difficult is it?
Personally, I love building things with my hands. So I'll often start with an idea and hot glue and foam core and you know, get my hands into it. And then maybe we'll 3D print something. Maybe we'll do a stop motion video of something. There's a lot of techniques I've used over the years just to visualize something and feel it and show it to other people. Often show it to kids, show it to toy companies, whatever that is. I think what's changed is it's become much more visual. For instance, being able to make a video of your idea has probably been more important than building a prototype recently, because if it doesn't show up on a video that could go viral, it doesn't matter if the thing works. Mm-hmm. You know, so often what my technique has been, and including Bop It, which a lot of people know, that famous video of me from very long ago with this foam core hammer, it was just taking an idea and making it believable in a video, sort of like a screen test. Mm-hmm. That was important 25 years ago, but who knew how much more important it would be today with TikTok and all the social media, where an idea can really spread through a great short video. And it doesn't have to be slick. In fact, sometimes it's better if it's not. So I think that's the part that's sort of democratic about it. I've seen kids that make much better videos than adults.
Right.
And if they have an idea, they can pitch it that way.
Right. And it really is about the content. You bring up a really good point, because one of the things I've been talking about is how the toy industry has changed. But there are certain things that are still the same. We are a long way from the 2-minute King Zor commercial in the 1960s from Ideal. But TikTok videos and other videos are really showing kids how to play with these things and engaging them in the play. It's really an important aspect of the toy industry today.
Have you looked at my social media, Bop It Inventor?
No, I will after this, and we'll get everyone to take a look too.
So that's why this background behind me, you can see with all the boppets and they're all on guitar hooks. Obviously, we're on audio. And that's my TikTok background. So 2 years ago, when the 25th anniversary of Boppet was coming up, I never even answered emails. That's how social media I was. But I just, during the pandemic, to jump into trying this to engage with fans, because I've had so many people come up, especially about Boppet, and tell me their stories from when they were little and how much they loved it, and, you know, abnormal amount of people. So I went on social media and started to tell stories about invention and about, I started to spoof Boppet a little bit and make fun of it and just engage with fans. And that blew up to 500,000 people. And of those 500,000 people, a lot of them have really good ideas. When I bounce off of, for instance, about failure, one of my favorite things to do is show them some of the many products that didn't get picked, rejections. And that's almost more popular than the success stories is, hey, why didn't this work? Mm-hmm. You know, think about the power of having thousands of people. And when you say, why didn't this work? Why did this flop? And the answers are really good. Even, uh-huh. You know, it's quite interesting. And so those are the kind of things that are, you know, wonderful about social media. And being able to show a slightly different video to them and say, do you think this works better? And people just love commenting on that. So, you know, it also creates this super engagement between the creator and the users and the fans.
And that's one of the things I think is so significant about the toy industry right now. We are living in communities. These are brands are communities, but whereas during sort of the 60s, 70s, even up till recently, it was a one-way communication. Now your consumer not only has valuable things to tell you, but expects to be engaged with you.
And that one-way communication, think about it. It used to be three networks, right. You know, let alone a toy company would ever have the inventor at all mentioned. So now you skip all that. And as a creator and inventor, you can set up something like I did and talk directly to the consumers and get recognized. But it's more about really, it's so satisfying, you know, to come up with an idea that normally it takes 2 years to get to know whether an idea is good or not. I'll come up with an idea in the morning, not just a product idea, but sort of an idea for a fun, engaging video, something fans would like. And within about 1 minute of posting it, you pretty much know whether it's going to go or not. You know, this is so sensational that you get feedback on an idea that quickly.
And when you get that feedback, are you able to use that in your process of selling to toy companies, of licensing your ideas out? Are you able to leverage that and say, hey, here's what this random group of people, even though it's a self-selecting sample, had to say about this?
It depends a little bit. It's that thing where you never want to go into a toy company and say, oh, my kids love this. You
know, like that. Right. My grandma thought it was great.
Yeah. I've shown this to all of my family and they all think it's great. So you should buy it. You know, these are the things you don't say, but it is very different to show. I put these three videos up. This one went kind of viral. This one didn't, you know, just, you're not telling them that it proves they should buy it, but it right. certainly shows, it shows me what to do next with an idea, or especially the rejected ones. You know, I'm not going to throw up there a brand new concept or prototype, but I'm going to take something that everyone's seen already, throw it up there to see what did I miss. And I think that's pretty fun to be able to show that.
Do you apply for any kind of protection, IP or protection, before you show things on TikTok? This is Richard always thinking about this kind of stuff.
It depends. Maybe if it's something I already have intellectual property on, like Boppet, you know, and I try to be very careful with people and say, this is just for fun. You'll get people all the time. What do I get on this? Or I want to talk to you separately. I have a really good idea for you. I'd say, no, this is all public. Right. If it's publicly shared, anyone can take this information. I'm not doing this just for me. I'm doing it to help people think creatively. And that's why I never take it privately. I just say it's all public. And yeah, if it's out there, I think sometimes it's not the intellectual property, as you know, an idea in the hands of the right person who has the right connections, the right, you know, what to do with that raw idea. I really believe it's about speed and the right touch and the right detailing, not so much the raw concept. So I kind of have to dispel the myth that it's all about the idea. It isn't. So I tell people, you know, we can share ideas and any one of you can take this and do whatever you want with it. you'll probably come up with 10 different versions of it. So you kind of have to just take away the intellectual property side. And, you know, maybe it'll bite you at some point where something's been publicly shown and you can't patent it, but maybe it meant you got to market quicker. So I think you have to just decide what's important.
And is that still important, time to market?
Time to market, especially with trends. You know, you see something that's trendy, things are moving pretty fast. You have to act quickly. The one, you know, there's a product that is out right now that's doing really well called Poppet, ironically, good. Not Bop, Poppet Pro. So for the last few years, these little dimples, you know, that you, the rubber right. dimples called Poppets have been very, very, very trendy. So on my social media, because I have Poppet, someone said, what do you think of the Poppet trend? And I said, what's the Poppet trend? And they said, those little dimples. I go, oh, I didn't know they were called Poppet. But they asked me because the name was similar to Poppet. And I had one in my office, actually, and was thinking about doing some game with it. Actually, the original inventors, the Costers, had given me one 5 years ago and said, do you have any ideas for this? I couldn't come up with anything then. But once it became trendy, I saw this and thought, well, what if this was more like a Poppet? What if it lit up and you had to put out the dimples? Could we light this up? So I went into the shop, built something with foam core and one of these rubber dimpled sheets that you reset the pops after you pop them. This was kind of a key. So here's a product on trend, very quickly moved over to Buffalo Games, who was producing the Poppets, got it out in 6 months, and it actually did quite well last year, and we're doing a lot more. That wouldn't have happened without me sharing stuff on social media.
Right.
So, and that it was so trendy kind of meant we had to act on it right away.
Right. And I've been hearing that a lot from people, is that where they're looking for ideas and innovation is on social media. They're looking to see what kids are playing with, what's on Pinterest, what's on Etsy, where are people spending their time and money?
Go right to the source. It's more than that. You have to know what questions to ask, what to show, what information to get back, what to do with it. Easy in hindsight to say, oh, I could have done that, as we all do. But, you know, that one moment of, I know there's something here, and if you're lucky, you know it when you see it. Like, oh, I think I know what to do with it. And then it was having the right company to show it to, because the larger companies couldn't act quick enough, like a Hasbro or Spin Master. It's like, well, that looks like a trend. We don't know if we can do that, versus the company that was doing it, that was already doing the Poppets, which was Buffalo, acted very quickly because they were smaller and they knew that they already had that trend sort of in their line. So as inventing goes, there's a lot of elements that make for a successful product. And a lot of it is having enough relationships where you can go to the right company right at the right time, in time to get something done.
Dan, before we let you go, I want to talk a little bit about your Poppet for Good organization, because I'm always inspired by people who set things up to give back after you've had a good success. Tell me a little bit about that and what you're doing.
Poppet for Good is simply something that my wife and I set up, an initiative, as we call it. It's not a nonprofit. It's really an empowering initiative to figure out ways to use Poppet to do the most good.
Uh-huh.
And that's because it's so powerfully embedded in the millennials' youth that now, as people become more, you know, they have families, they're in places of power, like comedians, writers, sports heroes. It's much more prevalent than you realize, and so much more. If you Google Poppet or on Spotify, you want to get blown away. Put the word Poppet in Spotify. And I could play you a song list of 50 songs that are really incredible, like hip hop. A lot of them are a bit adult, by the way. but it's unprecedented how deep it's gone into the culture, the pop culture, and I call it bop culture. So bop, but there is sort of a thing, bop yeah. culture, and it's really transcended beyond the game. Because of the music and the attitude and the tactile nature, it just took off in a way that outside the toy industry, this is not old news. This is recent. On TikTok, there's many, many spoofs and memes and a whole dance trend, or two or three dance trends based on Poppet. So it's a lot of those people probably never even had the toy. You know, they're just doing this thing. So I wanted to do something with this and with my notoriety. You know, when I meet someone, you're the inventor of Bop It, they get excited. So I could then use that to call people like celebrities or different sports heroes and say, hey, would you like to do something with me to use Bop It for the most good? And so we started Bop It for Good, where I created this thing last year called the Bop It button. You just bop it, don't bop it, were the two commands. Do bop it, do not bop it, with many, many different variations. And I put all the voices from the last 25 years into it as a kind of celebration. But I also put in cameos from people from TikTok who auditioned. My dad, who has a great voice, as Richard knows, who's 96. My own voice congratulates you if you beat it after an hour and a half. It's a really great product, but it was also something to prove that if you put a lot of voices in it, it's really powerful and fun to hear all these different voices. And so now I'm going out, and my wife, Alicia, and I are going out to different organizations and to celebrities to say, would you like to lend your voice for a cause? And you pick the cause. So rather than me saying, like, we're doing a lot with Lighthouse for the Blind right now, because people that are blind can play Bop It as well or better than people that can see. Uh-huh. And that's always been, so we've been supporting the local Lighthouse for the Blind by donating a Bop It to them that they can resell for everyone we sell through Bop It for Good. But the cool thing is, when you look at a celebrity who gets hit all the time for a charity that you, oh, can you support my charity? Instead, we're flipping it around and saying, what do you believe in? What are you passionate about? What is the thing that you're trying to get other people to join you in supporting? We can just use your voice in this cool Bop It. Your fans, we know, especially if they're in sports, have, you know, the half the stadium loves Bop It. If they had a Bop It with your voice in it, what do you think? What would you like to support with that? So that's what we're working on now. And it's got giant potential. Thinking of the most good you could do with Bop It, that's my, you know, invention, the invention of this new business model for good, which is how to really, I call it inventing good. How do you invent the most good out of something? And I really believe that is what's really driving me and Alicia right now, is we think we can raise millions of dollars by finding the right people to lend their voice to their fans. And when you multiply it across all these different sports or entertainment people that all grew up with Bop It, that love Bop It, we think it has tremendous potential.
And your new product is called Free Fall. And I have to say, when I saw it, it reminded me of something from 1969, which was the frustration ball, which my brothers had and that we played with incessantly in the house.
You nailed the DNA of this product. It is basically, that's when I said 22 years ago, I was working on, with my partners, Gary and Brian, we were working on how to make an electronic version of a frustration ball that would have lights that go on and you would have to get the ball to the right light in time. It was called Drop Zone. And this was an idea that Tiger Toys actually licensed from us. And we were working on it long ago. And it, you know, was turned out one of those rejected ideas in the cupboard. And over the years working on Perplexus, kind of thought about it. But then with Think Fun, it was different. It was like, well, can we make this a challenge puzzle rather than an electronic game? It made more sense that you would make like a frustration ball, but instead you had to figure out the pathway. It didn't just predetermine the pathway. And yeah, the thing is beautifully executed by Think Fun. It's not cheap. It's like a $35 toy. They didn't, right. They didn't go for the, it's gotta be $20 thing. It's like a beautiful sculptural piece that goes on your table that has this great translucent plastics and this beautiful frame. We couldn't be happier with how it turned out. So yes, it has the genesis of that frustration ball, but now you get to be more frustrated.
I personally can't wait to play with that with my brother. So it'll take us back. Well, Dan Klissner, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. When is Free Fall out?
I think it's out now.
Okay. This is the Playground Podcast with me, Chris Byrne, my co-host and cohort, Richard Gottlieb. We are supported by Global Toy Experts, The Toy Guy, and Beacon Media Group. We'll see you next time.